The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
That's right. It's Tuesday, February 1st, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. We will be talking today on the program to Heather Hurlburt. She is the executive director of the National Security Network. And we will be talking to her later in the program. A little discombobulated today, folks. What are you going to do? But let's jump right into it. More news out of Egypt. This is an interesting story. Google, apparently, as you know, right now there are hundreds of thousands of people who have assembled in Tahrir Square. Tahrir Square, I think translated into is Liberty Square.
Liberation Square.
Liberation okay. Square. And as of now, I'm not seeing any reports of any type of violence. There just seems to be a lot of people there. There have been some reports of tanks firing just into the air in Alexandria from last night. But for the moment, it seems that there is no violence going on in Egypt. Now, there are no phone calls and or very little phone service and virtually no internet service at all out of Egypt. However, we tweeted just the other night, last night, a geotagging thing that I guess is on. I can't quite tell who put this out. Maybe it's Google. I'm not sure, but apparently Google launched a special service, according to Reuters, to allow people in Egypt to send Twitter messages by dialing a phone number and leaving a voicemail. And so when you see the hashtag Egypt on Twitter, that was a essentially a transcribed voicemail. The service, which Google said was developed with engineers from Twitter, allows people to dial a telephone number and leave a voicemail. The voicemail is automatically translated into an audio file message that is sent on Twitter using the identifying tag Egypt. And it's not clear whether or not it's actually written into that or you can pick up audio, but I'm seeing some tweets coming out of Egypt. And it includes the numbers in which people are calling. So interesting. And we have another dispatch from twitterm.com. Out of Egypt. Do we know when this was?
No, it looks like it was more recent than the last few, but it looks like it may have been over our nighttime.
Okay, so it's probably over the past 12 hours. This is an Egyptian executive. Well, I'll let him speak for himself.
Yeah, hi. This is Amir Abdel Ghaffar speaking from Ma'adi, Cairo. We're actually all getting ready to head towards Tahrir, my friends and I. In a half an hour from now, which is about 11 o'clock Cairo local time. Everybody is out there to deliver one more time a very clear message to the system that we are not going to let go. We want our voices to be heard, and we want the message to be very clear. The change is imminent. This country has been in a stalemate for 30 years, and this status quo cannot continue forever. Otherwise, our children will not have a place in this country to live in, and raise their children.
So that was a message that probably came from about 7 or 8 hours ago. and guys getting ready to take his kids to the Liberation Square in downtown Cairo. And it's just fascinating what's going on. We're now hearing of reports of potential protests in Jordan. And according to CNN, there are protests being organized for Damascus in Syria on Saturday. Protests, according to there are Facebook groups, they're in Arabic, but CNN reports that protest organizers want better living standards, human rights, improvements, and a greater voice for youth, according to the Middle East Media Research Institute, a Washington-based organization that studies and translates news accounts, social media postings. One group called the Syria Revolution 2011 described al-Assad's rule as a dictatorship and showed torture YouTube videos of political dissidents in the country.
I don't know if you saw this or if this came out while we were prepping for the show, but it looks like the King of Jordan has dismissed the parliament.
Has dismissed the parliament now. I had heard that he had dismissed, part of his cabinet.
Sorry, it may have been his cabinet. Yeah, it's coming out an hour ago. It just says dismisses the government.
Well, this is all stuff that we will talk to Heather Hurlburt about, and in just a few minutes. The other big story of yesterday, and this was very much anticipated by people, a Florida District Court judge, Roger Vinson, has ruled all of the health care reform, all of the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. The federal judge in Florida, of course, this judge was appointed by Reagan. Now, we know that the judiciary is completely above politics. They would never, ever, ever, ever make rulings just simply based upon on politics. Certainly not right-wing judges, because that would be activism. This made-up word that really relates to nothing. There's either good rulings or bad rulings. And the idea that to the extent that activism means anything, it could be a measure of how often you thwart the will of the legislature. But the fact of the matter is, the Constitution is the Constitution. If the legislature makes laws that are unconstitutional, then so be it. But this federal judge in Florida became the first person to strike down the entire law. You'll remember there was another judge, Hudson, in Virginia, who ruled that the individual mandate was unconstitutional, but that the rest of the law was constitutional. In this case, Vinson held that Congress overstepped its authority by compelling nearly all Americans to be insured or pay a fine. That would be the individual mandate. And then suggested, because of the absence of a severability clause, and because the law is like a finely crafted watch, his quote, not mine, in which one essential piece is defective and must be removed, he ruled that the insurance mandate cannot be separated from the rest of the statute, and therefore the entire law must be voided. He writes, in a very strange... You know, this is very reminiscent of Bush v. Gore. You'll remember in Bush v. Gore, not only was every single legal scholar in the country shocked that the Supreme Court even took the case, they were shocked by the findings. Now, that is because legal scholars still, and maybe after that moment they came to realize it, consistently underestimate the partisanship, the raw, naked partisanship of the right wing in this country, and thought that somehow, because Scalia wore a robe, that he was above that, that Thomas wore a robe, that he was above that. And in that case, the ruling was so such an incredible stretch built on a foundation of sand that they specifically said nobody should ever cite this as precedent because I guess in their mind, God forbid it could ever cut in favor of a Democrat. But they were embarrassed by their ruling the moment they did it. But they knew who their taskmasters were. And so they said, don't pay attention to this as a precedent. This is a one-off. Which is about as inconsistent with the notion of the rule of law that you could have. And the way that law is developed, or it has developed in both the British and American systems since time immemorial. But this judge, Roger Vinnison, wrote, this conclusion is reached with full appreciation for the normal rule that reviewing courts should ordinarily refrain from invalidating more than the unconstitutional part of the statute. But non-severability is required based upon the unique facts of this case and the particular aspects of the act. This is not a situation that is likely to be repeated. There, Judge Vinson is saying, I fully understand that if the individual mandate is removed and the rest of the act is found constitutional, that will put Republicans on their heels because it will totally undermine the private insurance industry. And that's where the Republican Party gets a lot of its support from. And so there's been about 14 other judges that have either ruled it constitutional or dismissed the case because it was such a joke. Now, this is all interesting. The only real question here is whether or not the ruling could impede implementation of the law in 2014. Vinson did not specifically grant the plaintiff's request for injunctive relief, in other words, basically holding it up. But apparently, according to Ezra Klein on page 75, he said that he expects they won't implement the law given his ruling. So that's as well crafted, it seems, as his entire ruling. You won't glean anything from that. The bottom line is, folks, that experts think that this ruling is rather shoddy. One of the ruling's core findings, according to Lewis Seidman, a professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University, that the individual mandate is unconstitutional because it constitutes regulating economic inactivity as opposed to activity. He argued that the Constitution's, quote, necessary and proper clause explicitly provides for the regulation of anything that has an effect on interstate markets. And we all know that we pay higher insurance premiums, we pay higher medical costs because of the uninsured. When emergency rooms or doctors have to give free medical care, and they don't always, they will turn away a lot of people. But when they do give this medical care to people who are ill, and remember now, they usually get sicker because they have not been, they've not had insurance. So just like your car, if you hear it rattling, you don't do anything about it, or you don't change your oil, you're going to have bigger problems down the road. Right, Evan?
Oh, yeah.
And these costs are not just absorbed by the doctors. They don't just say, okay, I'm going to treat this person's diabetes, or this person's going to get diabetes medication for free, and I'll just eat that. No, they pass these costs along to the rest of us. So we're all paying for these uninsured people. And therefore, their lack of insurance affects commerce throughout the entire country. But all of what I am saying, and Seidman also said that the severability aspect, not necessarily that wacko, could very well be legitimate. But the long and short of all this is that it's going to go to an appellate court after the district court, and then it's going to go to the Supreme Court. And nothing really matters right now except for how Anthony Kennedy is going to vote. Everybody knows the 4-4 splits here. And it's simply a question of whether Anthony Kennedy, how he'll vote. Some people speculate that somehow, because Vinson's ruling is more extreme than Hudson's, in that he says the whole thing should be found unconstitutional as opposed to Hudson just saying the individual mandate, that the Supreme Court could land there. That will not happen. They will not just find the individual mandate unconstitutional. I just don't believe that's going to happen. Unless some bizarre, somehow Kennedy does, and then those other four are going to have to do something, because that will destroy the private insurance industry, and they have no interest in that whatsoever. And if you think that Scalia and Alito and Roberts and Thomas, when they go off to these Koch brother-sponsored get-togethers and soirees and meet with industry leaders, that they don't hear that. And by hear that, I don't mean just overhear it. I mean they're told, this is what we need you to do. And we'll have somebody at the Federalist Society write up a white paper so that you have something to hang your hat on. Thank you. Oh, and thank you for hiring my wife, Ginny, for $500,000 over the past 2 or 3 years. No kidding. No problem whatsoever. Would you like more poached salmon? Indeed I would. All right, we've got to take a break. We'll be right back with Heather Hurlburt, the executive director of the National Security Network. Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar. On the phone, Heather Hurlburt. She is the executive director of the National Security Network, and she served in the Clinton administration as special assistant and speechwriter to the president, speechwriter for secretaries of state Albright and Christopher. She's also worked for the International Crisis Group, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the Congressional Helsinki Commission. She is also a senior advisor to the U.S. in the World Project of Demos. Welcome to the program, Heather.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be with you.
So I wanted to first, obviously, touch base with you on what the latest developments are in Egypt, to the extent that you're aware of them.
Well, I think everybody got very excited about an hour ago that there were some Twitter rumors again that Mubarak had left the country, but as far as we can tell, those are false. So it's interesting that everybody's watching that. The big development today, of course, is what happens as the hundreds of thousands of demonstrators in the square in central Cairo try to reach the presidential palace, and whether the army saying that it won't use force is able to hold. And third, that today is the first day of meetings between government officials led by the new vice president and the steering committee of opposition groups. That's where we hope the real negotiations toward a transition are taking place. So three things to watch today.
Now, why are these meetings happening with the vice president as opposed to the president? And when we're talking about the vice president, we're talking about Omar Suleiman, yes?
Right. Omar Suleiman, career security official, longtime head of Egypt's intelligence services. The general thinking is, Sam, that well, first of all, Mubarak is 82, has not always been in the best of health. And number two, that the military leadership, which is who really holds all the power in the country at this point, understands that Mubarak will have to go. But the problem at this point is, first of all, what is this a transition to? And second, what is a way of allowing Mubarak to leave that allows him to save face? And allows him to leave reflecting, you know, in particular the military's feeling that he's done a lot of good for the country as well as a lot of bad, and that they're not interested in seeing him chased out of the country. So I think that's the tenor of the conversations that are going on.
Now, Will, do you think that the Egyptian people will accept Omar Suleiman as president? I mean, I think my listeners, we had discussed this yesterday, but he is the person that we extraordinarily rendered people to when it was time for torture. My presumption is that he also had some domestic clients as well for torture, and I presume that the Egyptian people know this.
Well, even worse than that, he presided over the security services, which are four times as big as the Egyptian army, and which have been the instruments of keeping Mubarak in power all these years. So, you know, pretty much every Egyptian family will have had some bad experience with them over the years. And so, no, if I think the idea is that all you do is swap Mubarak out and Suleiman in, that's not going to work. Now, what is more likely or more to be hoped for is that there's some kind of more transitional arrangement. Certainly what I think Washington is trying to get at is that this leads to elections at some, you know, there were supposed to be presidential elections in Egypt this year. It was clear that they weren't going to be very open presidential elections. And so the question is it possible both would the public accept and are Suleiman and the military actually willing to set up some kind of transitional system that ends in truly free and fair civilian elections later this year.
Now, you had a great piece in on
New
Republic just the other day, five things to keep an eye on. And the thing that really struck me is you're making the point to watch the military. And one of the other things that struck me was that just, and I'm gonna presume this is a coincidence, but maybe it's an indication of just how close the U.S. military and the Egyptian military are, that as these protests started breaking out, there were high-ranking military officials, Egyptian officials, meeting with their counterparts in the Pentagon, just, I guess, as a routine, I presume, unless you know differently.
Well, I don't know differently, and they do meet all the time because the coordination at senior levels is extraordinarily close. And basically, you know, everybody at senior levels in the Egyptian military will have spent some time in the U.S. studying at one of the defense universities or at one of the service academies or, you know, doing joint training. So there would normally be all kinds of back and forth, but I think it's also the case that Egyptian military leadership looked at Tunisia and understood very well what was going on, and also understood that they, because there is this amazing tradition, you know, Sam, that despite all the repression and all the things that have gone on in Egypt over the decades, the military has never fired on its own civilians. That it really has had a very different tradition and a very different relationship, and as a result, there's a lot of you know, fondness between the people and the military. And you've seen these scenes that are just unimaginable in most countries, including, frankly, in the U.S., you know, where protesters are painting anti-government slogans on tanks.
What accounts for that? Is that because the military is more based on conscripts than let's say, the special police forces?
Well, that's the key thing to watch, in a way. The key divide in Egyptian society right now is between the military leadership, who, as I said, are all, you know, elite, highly educated, trained in U.S. service academies, spent lots of time with their Western counterparts, and the actual rank and file of the guys who would have to do the shooting, who are conscripts, who come from all levels of Egyptian society, you know, who are not necessarily folks that are fluent in English and have spent lots of time at Fort Leavenworth or NDU or whatever. So that, in a way, is the key is the key fault line in Egyptian society. But the other thing to point out, you know, why do they love them? The military is a symbol of national pride and national leadership and of how Egypt sees itself as being on the front line of defense of both African and Arab affairs.
Hmm. Now, let me ask you this. What is you have this very, very close relationship between the U.S. military and Egyptian military. Even Suleiman, I guess, was trained at the Fort Bragg.
Yep.
Now, when they come into the room and they sit down, I mean, how much influence do American military personnel have over Egyptian personnel? I mean, I know that we give, a billion plus each year, mostly in either weapon systems or I would assume just bonuses maybe for Egyptian military. I mean, to what extent are U.S. what influence do U.S. military personnel have over what the Egyptian military does in this regard?
Well, ultimately, they're going to make their own decisions about what they think is necessary to secure their survival as individuals and the Egyptian military's survival as a highly influential actor in Egyptian politics. The military is also very enmeshed in the economy. Your listeners may know something about how the military in China has started businesses and has really benefited from opening, and there's some of that that's gone on in Egypt. So you know, nobody should deceive themselves. The Egyptian military is not going to commit suicide because the U.S. military tells them to, that they're going to follow first and foremost their own self-interest and what they perceive as their national interest.
But,
however,
but isn't part of their own self-interest is also to maybe listen to the guys who are paying them a lot of money? I mean,
yeah.
You've
so,
got
so that's going to be one core interest, but it's not going to be the only core interest. I mean, the same as, you know, Sam, one of your core interests is to keep getting paid by the guys who pay you, but it's not your only core interest.
That's my only core interest.
Yeah. So we have influence, but we don't have complete and total. They're not puppets. It's not like having our troops there. They haven't sworn a oath of oil. They don't get up and sing the American national anthem in the morning.
I understand. All right. I mean, because I have to imagine, you know, there's WikiLeaks. There were WikiLeaks cables that have now been released that show that at the very least there was a sense that Suleiman was one of their favored, one of the U.S. favored replacements for Mubarak. And I'm curious as to what point the military has influence in that regard, and then also sort of looks at the picture and says, yeah, that was a different time, though, because we just don't think we can get this guy through at this point.
Well, you know, there's a very interesting debate going on among people who know a lot about Egypt about whether Suleiman wants to be out in front or whether he prefers to be the power behind the throne. And so I think that's another sort of piece of this debate. But yeah, the Egyptian military are going to listen to what the American military is telling them and are going to try to draw their own conclusions about how much they have to open up and how much they have to let the civilians in, frankly, versus how much they have to make their own decisions internally. Then they're also going to look at the Egyptian public and say, you know, for all the reasons that you and I both said earlier, if Suleiman's not acceptable as the guy out front, is there someone else who's younger? Someone who's maybe not so tainted from the intelligence side of the house, and is there going to be an attempt to put someone else or several someone else's forward?
Well, let's talk about El Baradei for a moment. Do you have a sense that of what the American government or what his relationship is, maybe more importantly, with Suleiman?
Well, El Baradei, you know, has always had a bit of a prickly relationship with everybody. You know, we know that he wasn't afraid when he was at the IAEA. He wasn't afraid to criticize the Bush administration. He wasn't afraid to criticize the Europeans. He was very much his own man, and he didn't particularly care if he was loved or not. In a similar way, he's perceived as a little bit aloof by Egyptians, and that, you know, he was living in Vienna. He actually had to come back from Vienna when the protests started. He's been active for over a year in Egyptian politics, but there was always this perception that he couldn't really unite people around him. He didn't have a big organization. He's not what we think of as a charismatic mass politician.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I, you know, I, my understanding that is that in part because all the phones are down, but also, frankly, in part because clearly he wasn't going out of his way to try to be close to the U.S., that as of yesterday, the U.S. ambassador in Cairo had not even been able to talk to him.
Right. Do you have a sense of what, I mean, I imagine his relationship with Suleiman can't be very good either.
No, that would certainly, I mean, he, you know, and they had him under house arrest for a day there. So, so no, I wouldn't think so.
And let's talk about the Muslim Brotherhood. I listened to Glenn Beck almost 23 hours out of the day. And my understanding is that the Muslim Brotherhood is going to, this is all part of bringing about the caliphate. Is that?
So, yeah, I mean, that Glenn Beck piece was just horrifying because it just got a lot of really basic facts wrong. And the sort of the first, look, the first fact you need to know about the Muslim Brotherhood is that it is committed to a very conservative vision of Islamic society. It's quite hostile to Israel and to U.S. foreign policy, and nobody should be naive about that. But at the same time, who else are they also deeply hostile to? Al-Qaeda. They had a profound falling out with Al-Qaeda. There's armed violence between the two groups. Mm. So, you know, in a crazy way, if the enemy of my enemy is my friend, Muslim Brotherhood is also interested first and foremost in creating change in Egypt. If you think about it, they are not interested in attacking the U.S. They're not interested in making war in Afghanistan or Iraq. They're interested in changing the society they live in. So that's the first thing that people ought to know. The second thing that people have to know is that the Brotherhood split in Egypt, and the majority, or as far as we can tell, the majority has accepted peaceful political participation. And because they did that, they renounced attacks on Westerners and other things they had done in the past. And because they did that, frankly, they're one of the largest, if not the largest, organized opposition forces in Egypt. And so whether we like it or not, they're going to be part of the equation for what comes next. And, you know, there's a smart, savvy, cautious way to handle that. And then there's a kind of foolish fear-mongering, make your worst nightmares come true and, you know, cause Egyptians to think that we think they're all members of the Brotherhood way to handle it, and that's what Glenn Beck is doing.
And let me just got a couple more questions for you. To what extent do you think Obama's speech, I mean, the only thing I remember about Obama's speech in Cairo now at this point, you know, without having gone back to it, let's say 5 days ago, if somebody had asked me, was just that the right wing jumped all over him for being an apologist and for giving that speech. To what extent do you think that speech in some way affects things on the ground? I mean, it seems to me that it's got to be somewhat minor. I mean, there have been 1,900, was it, protests over the past 5 or 6 years by workers. I mean, it seems like economic conditions have been driving this.
Yeah, I mean, the Egyptians, first and foremost, deserve credit for this. This happened because their economies are terrible and because it's become more and more apparent, and there's been more and more debate and discussion in the Arab world about, well, why is it that all this has happened to us? It's nice to blame the West, but ultimately a lot of people in the Arab world are saying, no, we have to take some responsibility for this ourselves. And I think, you know, that's the first intellectual stream that you see this coming from. But it's also the case that, you know, and this, I mean, as you say, is not the Fox News version of it, but when Obama went to Cairo, he challenged everybody in the room. He said, you know, the U.S. has not always done everything right. He said, but at the same time, the Arab world, the Muslim world, you know, is as capable of democracy, loves human freedom as much as anybody else, and you all need to find ways to work on that for yourselves. Your governments need to grant you more rights. Your civil societies have more you can do too. And he, you know, he challenged both the Arabs and the Israelis in that speech on, you know, the issue of working together and doing what both sides say they want to do. So there was a lot of here's a door, will you walk through it? And I think the one small thing, you know, again, the Egyptians and the Tunisians deserve the primary credit for this, but I think Obama did succeed in conveying the message that democracy movements in the Arab world wouldn't be received exactly the way they've been received in the past, which was, we'll encourage you right up to the moment that you threaten to change anything, at which point we'll say, oh, no.
All right. And just lastly, let's just talk about the regional implications of this. There are reports that there are protests planned for Saturday in Syria, according to CNN. There are there seems to be at least something going on in Jordan right now where the king has dismissed his government. What and also I imagine there are people huddling and doing a lot of discussion in Israel right now. What are you hearing in terms of what this may mean in other Arab countries and in Israel?
Well, you know, and I was fascinated. There were protests in Moscow yesterday. This has really electrified the world in a way that I don't think we know. I don't think we know where it's going to go.
And I think people are upset about the cancellation of maybe or who won the last Dancing with Stars here in this country too. So this is spreading like wildfire around the.
Yeah, look, I mean, the Israelis are nervous, and legitimately so, because the only kind of opposition that's been allowed in Arab countries for so long is anti-Israel opposition. And so there's a lot of economic anger and political anger that gets channeled at Israel because it can't be channeled anywhere else. And so when some of those restrictions are lifted, you know, the Israelis rightly sort of aren't really sure what's going to happen. I also think, you know, each of these cases is different. Egypt isn't unfolding quite the way Tunisia did. Syria will be different again. Jordan, also sort of a different set of pluses and minuses. So I'm very reluctant to predict anything except that the next few months are going to be very interesting and that the Arab-Israeli peace process is not 6 months from now going to look the way it did 6 months ago, that some things are changing in the region for good.
Interesting. All right. Well, Heather Herbert, I hope you'll join us again as these events unfold. Executive Director of the National Security Network. Appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks. Look forward to coming back.
Okay, folks, we have got to take a break. Actually, I guess what we'll do is we will take a break and come back with our post show. You can IM me at Majority FM or Sam Cedar Show or Cedar MVS or any of my old IMs. And folks, let me take this time. I want to thank some of you who have been who have upped your membership, and I want to ask all of you who are listening to the sound of my voice, if you can become a member, please become a member. It's extremely helpful. We are trying to jerry-rig stuff in the office here. We want to buy some new cables to get rid of some hums here and there. You may already have noticed some of the audio improvements that we've made. Every time you join and become a member, whether it's at the $10 level or the $15,000 level, we don't even have a name for that. And we don't need one right now. But anytime you join, it is a huge help. We're going to put up other mechanisms to pay soon if you are against PayPal. But please, if you can become a member, much appreciated. And, of course, your support when you buy coffee at justcoffee.coop with the 10% coupon code MAJORITY, we reap benefit from that, too. So it's like a fourfer. All right, folks. Tomorrow on the program, Chris Hayes will be here to talk about his experience in Davos. Later in the week, we'll bunch. A lot more coming your way. Stick around for the post show. We'll be right back. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. We are back. This is the post-show show.
I saw something yesterday. Somebody had a tagline about the Majority Report, and it was like a quote. It was like, the Majority Report. where gray matters.
Oh, I like that.
It was nice. Did you see that thing that was on the Turks?
Yes, that's very funny. Somebody took... Yesterday, I was explaining that I thought why the Egyptian military, why the American military had some influence with the Egyptian military. And I don't know if anybody noticed it, but the well-versed and expert we just had on verified my my point. She didn't use the same analogy I did with if Cenk was actually paying Evan and Dorsey, how the Young Turks would start to, you know, why Cenk would sort of manipulate my ability to put out YouTubes or what.
Yeah, I wasn't convinced that maybe we should do like a dry run.
Yeah, maybe we should do a dry run. Maybe we get and do that for a month where Cenk pays you guys.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Maybe you should pay me too and see if he can influence me. But somebody on the Young Turks board posted what I said, but not as a joke or not as an analogy, just as if I had secretly found out the plan of the Young Turks. We had some people email us, go, hey, you got to deal with this. There's some type of problem with you and the Young Turks. And that's great. Stuff like that, we want to encourage that. Look, folks, every time you post one of our videos or one of our audio clips that are embeddable on your blog or on somebody else's blog or on a comment page, every time you talk about the show, you understand that it builds our audience, builds our influence, increases the ability for us to get even better guests. Although, frankly, we've not had a circumstance where I've asked for a guest and we didn't get it. You know, to the extent that, like, some guests are hard to get.
Well, Mark Maron.
Yeah, Maron's the only one. Maron's the only one who will not come on the show.
He's scared.
I asked Jessica, I said, can we get Michael Pollan? She's like, I'll try, but he won't come on any shows. But if it's somebody who goes on any shows, we can get him. And it hasn't been a problem. There has not been a single problem. Chris Hedges writes during this period of time, so we're going to do a pre-tape with him. I mean, anybody. It's just I tend to go for people who are sort of more in the more in sort of the trenches and the policy stuff. And I don't really care to talk to politicians that much. But, you know, as the need arises, and we've been able to get anybody. So I guess my point is, yes, it helps when you post anywhere, and it gets us more listeners, and it also brings in the potential of a new member. Every time we get a new member, guys like Tom DeLay lose a little bit of their sphincter control in heaven. That's what happens. Every time we have a new Majority Report member, Glenn Beck doesn't know it, but he has to up his medication. Cool J146. Oh, this is a funny story. I'll save some of the other stories for tomorrow, but this is a funny story. I don't know if any of you follow me on Twitter. Or, and if you do, you should also follow the Majority Report. We tweet different things. Sometimes I retweet Majority FM, but frankly, lately, I got to say, I think Majority FM is a more interesting Twitter feed than mine. Kudos to you, Dorsey.
Thank you.
But if you follow me on Twitter, you'll know that there's been times where I start getting into Twitter wars with Andrew Breitbart. Because he's so crazy, and I got to say, politics aside, there's a quality of Breitbart that reminds me a little bit about Maron. They both, like, I don't know what it is about those guys, but there are some people who I meet, and I don't even see their face. I just see one huge button. Like, I know exactly how to push their buttons and drive them crazy. And Breitbart's one of those guys. If you go back and look for if you go back and look for some of those exchanges, I drive Breitbart crazy, and he cannot figure out. He can't figure out how to, you know. And it's really, this is really sophomoric stuff I'm talking about here. These are not policy arguments. I've had policy arguments with people on Twitter too. These are not that. These are literally like the stuff that you would hear if you were like in seventh grade, and two kids were on the playground. But you know, with Breitbart, this is what he trades in. This is his only currency. You understand that that's all he does. And so my feeling is that if I have the time and I can take him off his game, you know, so that he's not doing evil things like manipulating video or lying on his website that gets into the bloodstream of the right wing, then that's good. And so I'd like to fuck with him. And he, for the life of him, he just can't figure out who I am. And I don't blame him. He's trying to figure out, like, who do I work for? What? Why am I doing this? And it really is not apparent. And it's a question I ask myself. I mean, I once spent months. I have 200 pages of an exchange that I had with Nigerian email scams. I have three or four phone calls that I recorded. And my wife just looks at me and she says, why are you doing that? And so I had to pretend like, well, I'm going to turn it into a one-man show just to justify why I was spending all this time doing this. Why every time the phone rang at our house, at our apartment, I had to turn on a tape recorder because I thought it was, could be these Nigerians calling me from Nigeria. And I will post that someday. It's now 10 years old. But it, you know, and so I just get caught on these jags. And so I love the shit on Breitbart. And this is another classic example of Breitbart. We all remember, I hope you all looked at the video of Michelle Bachmann when she gave her State of the Union rebuttal. I guess that's what you could call it. When she was talking to her invisible friends to the right of the camera feed. So Breitbart, you know, and we all figured out the story that there was two cameras and she was talking to the Tea Party one, and then it became this beautiful metaphor about how you cannot talk to the Tea Party and not seem crazy to the rest of the country. And Breitbart jumped on this story and realized that this was a plot. Yes. A plot by CNN to make Michelle Bachmann look crazy. It was a secret plot hatched in a basement somewhere. How can we possibly take this incredibly sane woman, Michelle Bachmann, who believes all these incredibly sane and measured and reasoned things? How can we take her and make her look foolish and crazy? We've got to come up with some type of super plan. We must use our operatives at CNN to plant a camera to her right. Use that as the feed. And then the world will think that she's crazy. And of course, this is what Andrew Breitbart reported. He said CNN sabotaged Michelle Bachmann's Tea Party response by setting up a camera in such a way to make her look crazy. Up. Whoops. Turns out that Fox News was responsible for the setting up that camera and that video feed. Whoops.
Hey, what happened?
Fox News set up the news feed. Oh, my God. You realize what this means? Fox News is with them. So Breitbart had to rescind that. Like, he has... There's almost no story that Andrew Breitbart comes out with that isn't completely fictional. It's just a question of how fictional is it with him.
He just seems like he's getting sloppier and sloppier as it goes along.
I mean, before, no, he's always been sloppy. It's
but
just
I mean, before,
that now,
at least he had some kind of, like, he could get away with it a little bit. Now it's just, well, not even trying, you know?
Well, what's happening with Breitbart is two things. One, people are actually scrutinizing everything he says now because he has such a record and a reputation of fabricating things. And then the second thing is, he is, because he's getting less acclaim after the whole Charlie Sherrod thing, and after, you know, his little protege got arrested, O'Keefe, and after it came out that all of O'Keefe's stuff were doctored too, he's got to get more and more outrageous and crazy to maintain his viewership. And so Breitbart's got a real problem. I think deep down, this is the thing with Andy Breitbart. Deep down, I think he really wants to be accepted in the mainstream. I mean, I think that's why he left working for Drudge, because he felt that it tainted him too much. And maybe I think their Drudge was up to things that actually disgusted Breitbart. I wouldn't know what those things are, but I can only imagine. And I think Breitbart, actually, they were so repellent, they had nothing to do with ideology. It had to do with, like, personal behavior, that Breitbart may have gotten too disgusted. And then I think the reason why Breitbart went and tried to work for Arianna Huffington at the beginning of the Huffington Post, before it even actually formed, was because I think he wanted to actually be part of this group that he aspires to. I mean, the guy is from, he grew up in Westwood, in California, sort of in the shadow of Hollywood and Beverly Hills. And I think he wanted to be, you know, one of those sort of like Hollywood lefties. And I think what must have happened is he got rejected by them. And that's why everything he builds, like he built like this big Hollywood site to mock Hollywood. You know, like who gives a shit about it? I mean, who gives a crap about Hollywood enough to set up that whole thing? But I think it's all for him very, very personal. And I think he feels rejected by these people. And this is his way of saying, like, if you're not going to let me into the club that I think is cool, then I'm going to start my own club saying how much you guys are not cool. And it's sort of that classic case of a guy sort of projecting onto this club a certain exclusivity that nobody else really sees or cares about. So I think he really wanted to be mainstream, and now that he can't, he can't even go far enough on the right. I honestly do feel bad for the guy to a certain extent. And then I don't. I have a moment where I do, and then I don't. So, I just hope he gets better soon. And speaking of which, I listened to Marin's podcast with Gallagher. I could not. And you know what? I'll tell you something. I think I'm on Gallagher's side now. I listened to the podcast, and I got annoyed by how much Marin was sort of teasing the interview. It was clear Marin felt like he mishandled it. Now, it's great to listen to. It's incredibly entertaining. I mean, I got here, and for 20 minutes, I just sort of walked around listening to it. And very entertaining. I think Marin got a little concerned that he came off a little bad. And so there was a lot of buildup to this interview. And, you know, I'm not a fan of Gallagher, and I think his jokes are sort of stupid, and his, his homophobic jokes and whatnot. I actually think that Gallagher may tell those jokes because he may have trouble sort of accepting his own sort of orientation. That's complete speculation on my part. But there was a weird moment where Marin said something to him about Gallagher was going off about Lisa Lampanelli, saying, you know, you heard Lisa Lampanelli, and Marin's like, yeah, well, she fucks black guys, and then she talks about it. And he's like, well, what about that? And he's like, wait, what, you don't, why do you fuck guys? Is that what you're talking about? And Gallagher didn't even respond. And now, in the course of the conversation, they were both so heated at that point. And Gallagher's jokes are so homophobic that it's like, you know, it's almost, but it's weird. But I got to say, at the end, I thought, like, I think Gallagher outwitted Marin. And I, you know, I'd give Marin an opportunity to refute this, but he just doesn't, he just seems not to, I don't know, want to come on the show. I'm not, he's afraid or what? He's the only guy who will not come on the show. I can get James Galbraith. I can get Jacob Hacker. I can get Heather Herbert, who has, I'm undoubtedly has been, you know, sitting, probably has been, you know, at the White House multiple times this week. But I can't get the guy who plays Chuckle Huts up in, you know, wherever is Spokane or wherever he's. I don't know. Matthew tells me that today may be Breitbart's birthday. Yeah. Well, I just gave him a little present. I just told the world how crazy he is. Cool J 146. Sounds like an FM. You're listening to Cool J 146 coming up next. After the break, we'll get a blast from the past. She will survive. Gloria Gaynor. Sorry for the long question. Sam, I often don't think it's worth to have political discussions with friends and family. I don't want to alienate myself from otherwise good people. Many of these people are so firmly entrenched in their views that I feel like nothing I say is going to change their minds. For example, I have a Jewish friend. I don't want to hear from you. Who seems able to only regurgitate Hasbro talking points, I don't know what that means, regarding Israel. And one must not even consider sympathizing with terrorists, what he deemed everyone on the Mavi Mara and other Palestinians. However, when not discussing politics, as a great guy and friend I'd like to keep, does this aversion discussion with such propaganda as people make me a responsible, politically aware person? Friends and family are some of the most influential people in our lives. No! No, it doesn't. No. Listen. If you can be friends with somebody who has a different orientation than you politically, do so. There's no reason not to. Oh, Hasbro, Hebrew, roughly translated into public relations. No, I don't think so. I mean, there are some people that I cannot be friends with because of their beliefs, just because it gets in the way of our friendship. But, I mean, if it doesn't get in the way of your friendship other than when you bring it up, don't. I would also suggest perhaps taking a slightly different tact with these people. You do not confront these people head on. You confront them sideways. Shave off parts of their arguments slowly over time. But no, I don't think that makes you politically irresponsible not to be friendly with people whose views you don't share. I just think that, you know, but when you get into conversations, you can either end the conversation, but don't censor yourself. '64828, can you tell me the name of Sam's theme song? I guess you see me as a number, but I am really Dog Fido. I see you all as numbers. Sam's theme song. Is it Pressure Drop? Is that what you're talking about?
Should we do a little trial? Is this what you guys mean?
That's Pressure Drop. Okay, Trip. Morning Joe today. A joke today. Scarborough kept saying that this Florida judge was a good friend of his. Was a moderate. His wife may even be a liberal, even though they possibly have not voted for him for Congress. Uh-huh. Yeah. G Beard, anyone mentioned you look awfully grim in that Ring of Fire banner on your homepage? Having said that, I don't like grinning mugshots either. Nobody has said that, but I agree with you. Yes, I want it to be. I hate those pictures. Like, here's my fake smile. And the problem is, I can't do anything but a fake smile. I'm either grim or I have a fake smile. It's when we're posing. I can't do a. You know when I smile? When I go and I look and I go, oh, look at the new members that we have. Or, the Sinclair showed up!
Yeah, that was actually a great one. You smiling with the UPS guy.
Yeah, that was good. Sharif don't like it. You promised at one point to talk about Oberman calling out Ted Koppel. Still curious what your thoughts were. I was in total agreement. Mainstream media has totally kowtowed to the conservative meme about the liberal media. And they totally failed us in the run-up to Iraq. Didn't I discuss that? I think I did. I think you missed it, John Miles 27. You should call your post show I Am Sam or Sam I Am. Interesting. I think it may just be... members only show. It does now make me think of that stupid coat. Maybe I'll just call it the Majority Reporter show. God. I gotta hire like some type of marketing executive. Just saying, bring the fam and crew down here. Lots of room. 78 degrees today, Daddy Fru. Netflix is now on the bandwagon wagon for good net neutrality rules, I bet. We'll try and Facebook and retweet daily. Thank you. Breitbart is a self-absorbed gas bag. Glad if you can screw with his head. Thank you. Harold, I just figured out Twitter. I'm retweeting everything to my 4 followers. Does that help? Yes. Oh, and in fact, tomorrow, just got the email. Tomorrow, we're going to introduce you to a Twitter service that has been developed by our own Kyle Shank that is not only going to be a big help to the Majority Report, but this is actually going to be a device that is going to be very, very helpful in situations like where... WikiLeaks is trying to get stuff out, or people in Egypt are trying to get stuff out. This is going to be very, very helpful. I think this technology that Kyle has developed is going to be huge. Huge. And we're going to introduce it to you tomorrow. Bush and Chains. Neocon logic. When democracy comes to Egypt, Israel should start war. Bolton. If Mubarak falls in Egypt, Israel should bomb Iran.
What are you talking about?
Facts of Life star Jerry Jewell reveals she's a lesbian. Who's Jerry Jewell?
Was she the one that was on the Facts of Life? Is that what they just said?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember which one she was.
No, no.
Was she 2D?
This... No, who is she? She wasn't a Facts of Life. Jerry Jewell was popularly known for her portrayal of Cousin Jerry. Oh, on Facts of Life. I think that she must have come in after I stopped watching. Oh, she has cerebral palsy. Oh, she's in Deadwood. I didn't know. Oh, she's a lesbian. No, I made out with, what was her name? Nancy McKeon. One done, undone bird. Hi, Sam.
It's not quite Name Drop Friday.
Did you find out anything about how Native Americans' health care benefits would be affected by new health care? No, you know, I've asked people, and, you know, everybody was like, oh, that's an interesting question. Where could I find out the answer? I don't know. If you can ever get... I'll still try and ask people. If you can't get Krugman on the show, you could just get Paul Giamatti instead. Listeners won't tell the difference. What? Really? You know, I actually think I would have more trouble getting Giamatti than I would Krugman. Giamatti and I did a show together, and I've ran into him like over the years just once or twice. I haven't seen him in years and years. Maybe.
He
doesn't like to talk.
Yeah, I like him, and, you know, I have to watch the late night shows, and he's on, you know, a lot whenever he's promoting something. He was just on a lot promoting his latest movie. And, yeah, he even with, like, you know, very chummy guys like Jimmy Fallon, he still seemed kind of like he didn't really want to be there.
No, he doesn't like doing it.
Yeah. It really is turning into Name Drop Tuesday over here.
Have you ever tried getting Brad DeLong? You know, I haven't. I haven't, and I could. And, yes, his stuff is more technical than Krugman's, and I would want him for the right thing. But, yes, I read DeLong quite a bit. You should get Pete DeFazio from Oregon. Are you a fan? Yes, he's a politician, but deep in policy. Really impressed me with his interview on NPR regarding Obama caving to Republicans on tax cuts for the rich. I'll put it under advisement. Can we put down Pete DeFazio, Brad Lung? Let's see, Jimmy Reefer Cake. Yeah, Gallagher was badgering the shit out of Gallagher. Everything doesn't need to be political. It was awesome. Oops, I meant Marin was badgering Gallagher. The jokes weren't so homophobic as straight-up seventh-grade humor. Get Marin. You should tease him into it by saying how Gallagher outwitted him. Gallagher's manager called Marin douchey. Oh, he did? Where, Avant? If you were an emotionally damaged 20-year-old girl, Marin would come on your show. Can you have the Decemberists on again to address how they feel about Joe Scarborough's being their biggest fan? Yeah, we had the lead of the Decemberists on Majority Report. That doesn't seem like the basis of an interview. Upbeat Nihilist. Marin had a great quote about Anne Rind. He said on BRL, there are two novels that can transform a bookish 14-year-old kid's life, Lord of the Rings and Atlas Shrugged. One is a childish daydream that can lead to emotionally stunted, socially crypted adulthood in which large chunks of the day are spent inventing ways to make real life more like a fantasy novel. The other's a book about orcs. Wait, did Marin quote that, or was it The Value of Nothing by Raj Pate? Was that Marin's quote? It's a good quote. Hey, Sam, I once asked Marin back in the break room days what his most favorite and least favorite thing about Sam was. He answered both with his condescension and exasperated sigh. You might work with that as you woo him on. Yeah. Well, you should have heard him with Gallagher talk about condescending. Morella, maybe you should do a few more MSNBC appearances to drum up subscriptions for your show. Yeah, I don't call them and say, hey, you're going to have me on your show today.
Maybe you should. Maybe you should just do that right now.
Yeah, I should. Oh, there you go. I think I'm going to do a Dylan Radigan show on Monday at 4. How is that?
Nice.
Sugar High 777. Why did it take so long for the lefty webosphere to hear about Beck's obsession with Francis Fox Piven? He's been citing Cloward and Piven as long as he's been on Fox News. Why?
We needed the right kind of chalkboard to put that together for us.
Right.
That's why.
Who's writing in red chalk? I can't. The posterior. That is the suggestion for the post show from Maxercise. David, Sam, do you have all the levels and colors for Obama's capitulation chart? I want to work on it. Right now it's just two, right? What was it? Light blue is he capitulates, and yellow is just, I don't know. Maybe I got to work on that a little more. Hi, Johnny, could you get Thomas Frank on as a guest? Sure. Would you write down Thomas Frank? Don't be a putz. Apparently the new number one way to signify you're a douchebag is to wear a leather jacket on TV. Just ask Mark McKinnon, John Heilman, and Tom Friedman.
Tom Friedman. Did you see?
No. Did he wear his?
Oh, it was,
you know,
from,
I'll tell you
from
something.
Davos.
I'll tell you. Oh, from Davos?
It was like John Stewart did a really good job of making fun of him.
In pilot season, and we can actually pull this and embed this clip, I think, there's a scene where my character, who is really... It was a huge stretch for me to play this. Huge douche. Just like a douchebag. Total douchebag like one of these guys. He flies to Nebraska to court to woo. Did you watch it? I gave you a DVD, right?
I've watched everything but pilot season.
Well, it's all right. I only gave it to you like 6 months ago.
I'm busy, sorry.
No, I understand. That's fine. You have time to watch whatever it is, Gotham Girl or Gilbert Girls or whatever it is.
Dancing with Stars.
So, my character is an agent from L.A., a manager, and he's flying to Nebraska to try and convince Broccoli, who's a farmer, to come out to L.A. so that he can represent him, because people are looking for a Broccoli type, Ross Broccoli type, because he was in a commercial. And so he pulls over his rental car, takes his sport coat off, says, you know, can't show up wearing this this monkey suit because it's going to be like, who's this L.A. asshole? And he goes, when you're in Rome, you got to do as the Romans do. And he pulls out of his trunk one of those leather coats. You know, it's just oversized, sort of like completely pristine. And he goes, Sky Mall, no tax. That's all I can think of when I see those jackets, Sky Mall jackets. And they are. You know that they buy them like when they're sitting in their first class and they just look at a Sky Mall like, sweetie, look at this. It's a bombardier's jacket. It's going to be good. It's going to make me look a little bit tougher. I'm going to be more street with this jacket. Zach Punk, they used to say only Nixon can go to China. It's starting to feel that way about every piece of foreign and domestic policy. It doesn't matter how conservative it might be. They simply won't accept it unless it was done by a Republican. That's all that matters. Saw the December at Beacon last week. They were awesome. Could you post the interview, the link to your interview? Missed it. You know, I saw that. I saw there. You know, I live around there, the Beacon, and I saw that. We can dig up that interview.
We can look for it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, maybe we'll put out like a majority. You know what we're gonna do? We're gonna put out a majority report bonus CD of all of music on the show. I think we've had Yo La Tango on the show. I don't think they played, but...
Eagles of Death Metal.
Eagles of Death Metal played. We did play that.
I don't know if we played it. I definitely cut it. We had.
Right. And They Might Be Giants played.
Oh, cool.
Oh, and Cowboy Junkies came in and played an incredible song. And I think the guy from the Decembrists, he played.
Let's do that.
Cowboy Junkies played that song. Oh, my God. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. Yeah, if you have music suggestions, put it in. We're going to put it on as a Majority Report bonus. Oh, he's got a double leather jacket. My God.
Yeah, I suggest checking out Jon Stewart making fun of him. It was really funny. It's on The Daily Show. It's the first video that pops up today.
Mark Maron's podcast isn't political or funny, so I don't see the appeal, says Long Doggy. I couldn't listen to him trip down memory lane about his friends from the old days and talk inside baseball about comedy. Boring. Majority Report is much better. Why, thank you. And he gets slightly more downloads than Artis. No, the one that sounds like the Ramones, it has some numbers in it. My theme song. It sounds like the Ramones.
It has some numbers in it?
Like, is it like 1, 2, 3, 4, and then they start playing, or what?
We don't have one of those.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Maybe it's the Gang of Four?
Oh, what's the song at the end?
Oh, that's
Pilot Season?
Yeah.
That's Pilot Season. That is actually a theme song from the show Pilot Season that is available on iTunes by Dave Derby.
I'll try to post a link on Facebook.
Thank you. G. Miles, do you think Rachel will have you on at primetime now that Oberman's gone? I'm guessing O'Donnell and Schultz are not calling you. If you're going to have bands on your shit, John McCrae from Cake. He's very political. Oh.
And very cool. I've always been a big fan of Cake.
All right, yeah. Put it down. You know, when we get the studio just completely rigged up, then we'll have somebody in studio with us. Do I think Rachel will have me on in primetime? My guess is probably not. I think Rachel likes to have journalists on more. I don't know that O'Donnell and Schultz won't have me on. They are not currently calling me.
I think that Radigan's like the perfect venue for you. The other
I like
is,
Radigan.
It's kind of you know.
You get more play when you're on though on primetime. People are more focused. It's just true. I don't know. Maybe someday I'll be on O'Donnell or Ed's show. Somebody just told me a story though, the other day, that he was on a plane. He got bumped up to first class, and in first class was O'Donnell, Brian Williams, some other people, I don't know. And this was in September, or maybe it might have been November at that point. And he walked by O'Donnell, and O'Donnell had his computer. He was Googling himself. He was going through everything. And that leads me to believe that some form of chilliness that I may have sensed from him was not in my mind. What are you going to do, folks? What are you going to do? All right. Okay. So once again, I have in some ways hindered my career because I was a little bit too explicit with certain feelings about things I probably could have ignored, but I can't help it. What am I supposed to do? Like, I spend all my time watching Sean Hannity. I could shit all over him. But, frankly, it's less interesting to me now. You know, like, I'll listen to Limbaugh on the radio. But Sean Hannity's a moron. Anybody who watches him is a moron. Or believes what he's saying. And those people, they're gone. They're not coming back. I will certainly, and we're going to have calls shortly. We're getting closer. I can feel it. And I'm going to do everything in my power to get, if every single call we got in here was a conservative caller, I would love it. Because then we can use them as examples. Then I can, they give us the opportunity to look at what's wrong with their arguments. But give me a break. Don't change a thing. I love hearing gossip about Air America, O'Donnell, et cetera. I know, but it gets me in trouble, obviously. I mean, I can draw a direct line to my mouth to every misfortune in my career. You know, I made the mistake when Elberg was head of Air America when we were in bankruptcy of just chewing him out, telling him he was an idiot. I didn't even get the satisfaction of saying it on air. Because I thought I was being discreet. But the moron didn't know what he was doing. I didn't say, you're a moron. I simply said, Scott, listen, we both know you don't know what you're doing. And he's like, yeah. And then, you know, I thought, what are the chances this guy who has serially failed at this job is going to be in a position to screw me over when we're bought out of bankruptcy? What are the chances? Well, whatever those chances were, folks, it just goes you. Long shots can pay off. He was the one who was like saying to Green, you got to get rid of Sam. Guest suggestion, Jeff Cohen from Fair. Yeah, he's good. I think he's good. Trip, Michael Daughtry. I don't know what that means. Send these an email form. It'd be even better. That way I really will be able to put them right in. I have a theory that Marin not coming on the show is designed to be a running bit that will garner both of you publicity. I don't think it garners him publicity. I don't think it garners me publicity. An interesting theory, though. Maybe I'm being cynical, but you're a Pats fan, after all, so you're capable of anything underhanded. Oh, and I heard they say you're going to be rooting against the Steelers in the bowl. Don't you, knowing the Steelers are climbing the stairway to 7, as in the Super Bowls, and nothing can stop the juggernaut? Well, it's not going to keep me from rooting against them. I think you're rooting for the Steelers just so that they will get more fans. I think you're too hard on Schultz sometimes, though. He's not the most intellectual voice, but his heart's in the right place. He speaks to a lot of people. When have I been critical of Schultz? That was the thing, is I was never critical of Schultz. That's the irony. I was never critical of Schultz. I worked for Air America. One of the other Air America hosts sent me an email. He said he heard that XM was not going to carry him on XM when Al Franken left. The XM channel was called the Air America channel. We were in bankruptcy or coming out of it. And I thought, okay, I'm going to be a team player. And frankly, I like Tom Hartman. I'm a fan of his. I was a fan of his before he was in any way affiliated with Air America. So all I did is I go on and I went to Elberg. I said, is this true? He goes, I don't know. Which, of course, was a lie. He did know, but he was trying to fuck me. And so I go on and I say, I've heard that XM may not be carrying Tom Hartman on Air America. They may carry somebody else. I think I specifically said, not a knock about the other guy. I'm just a fan of Tom Hartman. I like Tom Hartman. Now, on top of that, why do I not want the 12 to 3 slot to be an Air America show when I can go on there and promote my show? It's just a business. It was totally a business thing. And apparently, this got Ed pissed, and that was it. You know, I'm sorry. I mean, I suppose I could have been more diplomatic about it with him, but it's not my fault. It's just my price to pay.
As a cable news viewer, I am not a fan of Ed Schultz. But
that
has nothing
That's
to do
Dorsey
with-
said that.
That's me.
Dorsey said that.
Yeah, I'm usually the one who instigates that. I mean, I got nothing against him. It's just I'd rather see somebody else on television, personally.
Well, that's your opinion. You're fired, Dorsey.
Done.
I particularly like the Reverend Anti-Shopping Dude. Yes. Yes. Reverend
Billy.
Oh, they came in with the whole choir and sang in our studios.
Oh, man.
Republican lawmakers in South Dakota want to force everyone over 21 years of age to buy a gun by 2012. You know what? I know what that's about. That's their way of saying, look, if you can do it with health care, we can do it with guns. Interesting. Romney calls from, you know what I say? Go for it.
Do it.
Go for it. I think it's time that if we can, in isolated incidences, actually put some right-wing policies into place, go for it. Put some of those policies in place, see what happens. I'm perfectly willing to let South Dakota be, let's test it out. What happens when everybody carries a gun? Romney calls for Mubarak to resign. Oh, good for him.
He's doing the top 10 tonight on Letterman.
Is he? Oh, my God.
And he's, I don't know, have you heard about his book? It's like, No Apologies or something like that. And he's
No Apologies, asterisk, except from healthcare in Massachusetts.
He's going to try to, like, make himself into a Tea Party or something. Or he's been a Tea Party this whole time or something like that.
Jimmy Reefer Cake, I've listened to a few Marin podcasts. He's never like that. It disturbed him because Gallagher seemed like an interesting guy, and Marin was just out for blood. Any man who can get paid to smash watermelons can't be stupid. Dude, you can get paid to take a poop on a piece of plexiglass that someone's sitting underneath. You know, getting paid for stuff is not a measure of someone's intelligence. But I just think that Marin moved into it. Jimmy Reefer Cake disagrees. Okay. Getting paid to poo is cool. All right, fair enough. Avant, Punchline Magazine. I respect what Mark was trying to do, but he did it in a douchey way. You know, he did do it in a douchey way. He did. He came out. He didn't do it. He just immediately said, like, so you're doing racist and homophobic stuff, like, in the middle of nowhere, as opposed to going, like, let me ask you about these jokes. How do you perceive these jokes? I'm sorry, man. But I'd let Marin defend himself, but he's not here. Kevin Semicolon, when O'Donnell Googles himself, a clip from The West Wing comes up. Upbeat Nihilist. No, I think he was quoting someone else. Oh, yeah. Not sure if Raj Patel is the author of the quote. Well, did you put it into Google and see who... Let's put it into Google's. See who did that quote. Tukun. Jason. John Rogers, screenwriter, film producer, comedian, and comic book author, is the author of the quote. I don't know who that is. Born in Worcester, Massachusetts. Holy shit. Who is that dude? Wow. We gotta get this guy on. Dude was born in Worcester. I love it. He did Transformers and Catwoman and The Core and American Outlaws. That quote may be the best thing he's written. Just Google the quote and that was the first thing he came up with, so no warranty expressed or implied. Morella, my favorite time is when you were on with Chris Hayes. And the two of you together are quite something. I think your minds work the same way. Wonka, smart, and entertaining. Chris Hayes, I got to say, is significantly smarter than me. I mean, I like to think I have other talents that he doesn't have, although I can't think of them off the top of my head. But Chris Hayes is smarter than me. But what are you going to do? You know, he's coming on the show tomorrow. He is one of my favorite guests. Michael Dotti is the lead singer from Soul Coughing. All right, fair enough.
I think Bo knows him.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Schultz at times has sounded like Lou Dobbs talking on immigration on his radio. Otherwise, he's okay. Only in German porn. I don't know what that means. Rachel rarely has people on who are funnier than she is. Ever notice that? Well, John Hodgman. Nefertiti just saying hello. Someone has to keep the so-called liberal TVs honest. Torsi. What? Dude, you can't send me an IM that size. What do you think about this? The shift of the debate from a policy fight to a constitutional argument is a boon to Mitt Romney, who has a plausible campaign trail answer to questions on the issue. One of Romney's weak arguments was that Massachusetts plan was fundamentally different as a matter of policy because it had been enacted on a state level rather than a federal level. The argument got little traction. Romney's argument now is much stronger because the main objection to Obamacare is that it no longer a matter of policy nuance. It is so stupid. That's all right. That is so stupid. Politico thinks that because it's a constitutional issue that the right-wingers won't care. No, no. This wasn't founded on some notion of the Constitution. It was founded on liberty, on American liberty. No, sorry, Mitt. You know where that Politico, I can tell you right now, you know where that Politico story came from? A Mitt Romney advisor. Yeah. Period. Understand this, 90% of the stories in Politico, maybe it's 100%, but I try and give them the benefit of the doubt. 90% of the time you see a story in Politico, understand that it's been planted there, and it is a verbatim plant by someone on the right or the left. Okay? Long doggy. Two separate IMs. German porn has to do with paid for poop. Nothing so with Ed Schultz. I see. Taurusy 80. Though Ben Smith does have a... For all the talk of Huntsman's deafness, hasn't the timing doing politics while ambassador been a bit of a mess? Why not resign first? Absolutely. This is weird. But you know who's... You know who planted that? I mean, that's true. I think that's accurate. But that's also coming from the Obama administration. Hi, Sam. I was wondering if you took a look at the book I suggested, Political Pornology. I don't think I did. Send me another email about that. Sorry. Oh, my gosh. A lot of people. Bob Flav. It's actually Mike Malloy that refers to Schultz as a fake liberal. I never heard you say it. Thank you. From Bob, and I agree with what you said about Maren Gallagher. Gallagher kept saying it's just a joke. It's funny. I almost felt sorry for him. He was obviously a little clueless. Janet Scapin. Cowboy Junkies, if I remember you correctly, you're missing. No, no, no. Oh, you're missing. Is that the song? It was Winters. It was like a really haunting, and it was about the war. It's a beautiful song. Sammy Kammer, I think you once said right after Schultz began on MSNBC that he was not that bright. Well, I don't know. You don't need to be bright to make money. That was my point, wasn't it? You don't need to be bright. There's room for everybody. That's all I'm saying. One day, like Ted Knight, you'll be able to say, I built this podcast from the ground up, and I'll start with a small laptop computer in the Dollar Lunch District of Manhattan. Like Ted Knight? Buying guns versus buying health insurance. Everyone will need to use health care someday. Not so for guns. Well, here's the argument. Does the absence of people not having guns actually influence commercial activity across state lines or even in state lines? Someone would have to make an argument that because Evan won't get a gun, it is somehow costing me money. But if you don't have health insurance, it costs me money. But, you know, that's, you know what? That proves my point about the Politico story with Mitt Romney. It's not about the Constitution. There's no depth of thought in this argument. What do you think of the whole Egypt internet thing? Do you like Rachel Ray? What do you think about the law about high capacity clips? Mini flick. Well, the whole Egypt internet thing, I'm not exactly sure what that refers to, but I think it's been amazing. I think it's been important. I think it can be overblown, but I also don't think you can minimize the importance of real-time communication in the building of revolutions. I mean, there's, like I said the other day, there's been countless occasions where somebody uprises in one town that's out in a rural district or they're not aware that something's going on in the capital or whatnot, and there's been many occasions like this. The whole Cuban Revolution, the first couple attempts was had there been better communication, could have happened earlier. So I think it's incredibly important. And, of course, also it brings international pressure because these stories get out more. I don't know who Rachel Ray is. I know she's, like, got a talk show, right?
Yes, I mean, she's a daytime talk show host.
I've seen a commercial, like a, I think, for her for like coffee.
She does cooking shows.
Yeah, she's cooking. She's from Boston. You should know about her, right?
Oh, no, I don't know.
Yeah? Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the law about high capacity clips? High capacity clips. Oh, yeah, I think we should bring the Brady Bill back. Cooker, chef. Yeah, I agree with you. Okay. Abaddon. John Rogers writes the series Leverage and is the also the blogger at Kung Fu Monkey. Huh. Didn't know that. I wonder if I went to school with him. High school, that is. Jablowski. Hey, Sam. Can't remember the exact conversation. You once had a show once where you made a comment, something like a mile wide and an inch deep. I love that. It was spot on at the time. I think Ed is much better on TV than on radio. Don't like his radio show. Yes, I would say his TV show is better because he has to delve into topics in a different way, and I would agree with that. Sarah the Surveyor. Yo, Sam, aren't you going to try and blame Mubarak on me? Sarah the Surveyor. Aren't you going to try and blame? LOL. Anyway, do you think this guy Suleiman likes surveying too? Maybe he and me could chill and make some maps sometime. Love, Mommy Bear. Oh, gosh, I've gone over. I'm going to get in trouble with the podcast union. I'm not allowed to do this much time. All right, folks, tomorrow on the program, like I said, Chris Hayes. Fresh off his trip from Davos, he is, I'm going to ask a special request that he wears a Bombardier leather jacket when he's on the program. Can we Photoshop a picture of him wearing it? All right, folks, see you tomorrow. Become a member. I think most of you guys would imagine. Wow, we had a lot of, All right, talk to you tomorrow. I guess I'm where the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess I'm where I lost my drive. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes?